your favorite source for Chicago White Sox talk, delivering news, interviews, analysis, and more. This is the Sox Machine Podcast with your hosts, Jim Margulis, James Fegan, and Josh Nelson.
Thanks, Robin. Welcome to the Sox Machine Podcast. I'm your host, Josh Nelson, and it's very late. Thursday night, June 12, 2025, as we record this new episode, the Chicago White Sox just wrapped up their series in Houston. They lost 2 out of 3, but they play the Astros tough on Thursday night, battling to a 4-3 loss, even though it is another series loss, and the White Sox are 23-46 on the season. There are some positives from this series that instill some hope that better days are coming. Miguel Vargas balled out, Shane Smith was excellent, and we got to see the Major League Baseball debut of Grant Taylor. We'll recap the action in Houston, look ahead to this weekend's tilt as the Texas Rangers, or I should say the Texas road trip, continues with the White Sox heading to Arlington to face the Rangers. And this weekend is the start of one of my favorite events of the year, the College World Series. So let's get started. James Fegan is down in Houston, but he's wrapping up stories for us at the stadium, and he's got a flight to catch to get to Dallas. So joining me is the managing editor of SoxMachine.com. It's Jim Margulis. And hello, Jim. And yeah, the White Sox lose another series visiting Houston. They end up splitting the season series against the Astros, the 6 games going 3-3. But I feel like even though the White Sox lost this series, there are some positives that we could talk about. And one of those is Miguel Vargas. And Vargas went 4-for-12 in the series. He almost tied the game in the ninth inning with a deep fly ball to left field, just hit the top of the wall, the Crawford boxes, really close to fan interference for a moment. I thought maybe Vargas would have gotten that call and it would have tied the game. But he also made some sensational defensive plays in this series and showed some hustle with the base running. And Jim really looked like the White Sox best position player, especially Thursday night. What are your thoughts about Vargas in this series? Because I know that he hit like a cold streak before facing Houston.
Well, I think it was emblematic of the White Sox efforts overall. Like, if you looked at a series between the White Sox and the Astros, last place team versus first place team, and you thought, how might this go? You might say, well, the odds are the Astros will win out 2 out of 3. One game will be a close win. One game will be a blowout. One game will be a close loss. And it's basically how it worked out. Like, the White Sox played well in the opener. They did not play well in game two. And then they were just like out executed a little bit, or on the margins, that kind of made a little bit of a difference. But, you know, a ball breaks a different way in the case of Vargas's drive to left field, or one of the few leaping catches the Astros made in the outfield. You know, maybe it goes a different way. So, you know, all in all, the White Sox are 4-17 in one run game. So maybe they haven't earned those breaks yet. But overall, like you just say, like, that's kind of the series you thought you would get. I think for Vargas, he was in a little bit of a, you know, kind of malaise, I guess. Not quite a slump, you know, but not quite producing. And that carried into the opener a little bit as well. And it was good to see him bust out of it. The swing decisions are always good with him for the most part. It just seems like whether he's, in this case, it looked like he was maybe just bailing out a little bit, not able to cover the outer half like he was earlier. And looks like he straightened out, was able to drive the ball again. You had his lower body into it. And yeah, that part of the game was terrific. I think defensively was uneven. Like, you saw him make that great play over the rail, and then you saw him miss a pop foul and not quite cut off a grounder with the kind of precision you expect from like a good third baseman versus an average to below average one, which Vargas is grading out as right now. So I think you got the whole Vargas experience, for better or for worse. But I think, you know, what you're seeing is an eminently playable third baseman who, you know, when he hits the ball like he did tonight or Thursday night, if you're listening to it on Friday morning, you know, it's the kind of bat that can play elsewhere. First base if he has to play there, if he gets bumped there, DH if he has to spell there occasionally. And he stood out as a cut above too. And, you know, watching Framber Valdez cut through basically the entire White Sox lineup otherwise, with the exception of Edgar Caro. So yeah, it was a terrific series for him.
Yeah, poor Austin Slater. The platinum sombrero for Austin Slater. Thursday night, 0-for-5 with
Tim Elko might have gotten there too if he had the chances.
Yeah.
Like, they both look confused.
Yeah, at least Elko, I don't want to make like excuses for him, but he is a rookie. Austin Slater, your job is to hit left-handed pitching. That's why you're in Chicago. You're the first free agent. And
then Talkman does it.
Yeah. Talkman not only does it, he hits a home run.
Josh Hader. So, yeah.
So every time you see...
Baseball's funny.
Every time you see Talkman, Jim, and he does something well, it's like, all right, who is trading for Mike Talkman? Because he's on a heater right now. And
yeah, it's just a matter, I think, with Talkman, it's a matter of, like, teams watching to see when he can run full speed comfortably without, like, holding their breath.
Right. Yeah, that's true. That's a good point. Another thing I want to discuss with you, because I know we haven't chatted about it in a while, because runs are a premium for the Chicago White Sox team. Even though right now I'm on pace to lose the steak dinner bet, the White Sox are only on pace to score 568 runs. But we talked about Miguel Vargas, and I just checked because watching Edgar Caro against Framber Valdez, and in this series against the Astros with runners in scoring position, there's like no power from Caro, Jim, but I do like his approach when there's runners on second or even on third, especially when the infield is in, that he's just looking to drive the ball through the infield. And he is finding the gap somehow with his bat control to hit liners or grounders through the infield and get those RBIs. And I looked it up, and it brings up this topic of who do you want to see batting with runners in scoring position for the White Sox? And Edgar Caro has a .297 batting average, Jim, with runners in scoring position. If I told you that Edgar Caro has more base hits than Andrew Vaughn this season with runners in scoring position, would that shock you?
Maybe, but only just because of the disparity. Like, I figured it would be close. You know, just because Vaughn could be pitched to in those situations. And I think Caro is showing a nice, the hit tool is playing up better than I thought. I think it's, like you said, it tends to be a hit tool that might not shine on its own. It looks better when the defense is positioned for, say, you know, infield in, or, you know, really trying to cut down a run at the plate, or in the case of Thursday, shifted against him in a funny way to where he didn't really have to barrel it up. He just had to poke it through the right side, did it twice, able to thwart the shift. I mean, that's a very useful skill set. I think that was part of Gavin Sheets's appeal during his time with the White Sox. And one of the reasons why he was a favorite of managers was, you know, one, he had a cohesive plate approach, when it came to runners in scoring position, where it never looked like, even if he came away, you know, empty handed, it didn't look like he swung himself out of the at bats, you know, just having to be like, oh, just missed it. Or, you know, they made a good pitch on him, or, you know, hit it hard right at somebody. And in the case of, you know, before they banned the shift, like, he was especially adept at just dunking the ball in the left field, like having the third baseman gone and just, I'll just shoot it that way. Like, he had very good bat control, and that dried up on him a little bit when they banned the shift and required two infielders to stand on the left side, but still you can see the ability to do that. And I think Caro is similar in the sense that if he doesn't have to try to score the run by himself, you know, cause if he, you know, the one drawback of him settling for singles and walks is that, like, he, 270 feet is a long way for him with his foot speed. Like, he cannot go first to third very easily, second to home, even first to home. So, you know, you'd like to see more doubles from him eventually just to shorten that path. But in these situations you're talking about where all you need is a single for him to make a difference, yeah, he's somebody who, he can be pitched to in a way that cuts down his damage, but he can fend it off and make himself useful. And I think, you know, right now in his rookie season, that's a great first trick to have and a good way to keep yourself afloat, even if the overall numbers are a little bit disappointing. Trying to think about anybody else who's, you know, I think Mike Talkman coming back has lengthened the lineup in that regard of just guys you like seeing up. Chase Meidroth solidifying himself as somebody with a good plate approach, like, you want to see him up. So I think there are more hitters than there used to be who are dangerous with runners in scoring position. So I think that helps. But it is a matter of with the White Sox offense being one that doesn't generate a lot of homers. In a lot of cases, it's you strung together two great plate appearances. can you get three? And I think that's hard for a lot of teams to do, much less the White Sox, who are, you know, a lineup full of rookies and journeymen. And so that's why I think as bad as they are with runners in scoring position, sometimes it's their own fault in the sense of that they, you know, they got runners in scoring position with two good plate appearances, but they only went 90 feet at a time.
Yeah, this is where the base stealing really comes into play for the White Sox. How do they get to second base to take advantage of getting just two hits in an inning so they can find a way to score off of those two base hits? Caro this season is 11 for 37 with runners in scoring position with 16 RBIs this season in that situation. No home runs yet for Caro. Miguel Vargas, not a high batting average with runners in scoring position, but his OPS is 831. He has demonstrated some power with runners in scoring position. My favorite stat about Vargas, though, with runners in scoring position, he's got 12 hits this season, 11 walks. 11 walks at just four strikeouts with runners in scoring position. Really patient with power in that situation. Like, that's where it seems like Vargas is in his ideal spot. So that's why it still makes sense to continue batting him third or fourth in the lineup.
Yeah, and a little bit different too from, say, Luis Robert Jr. In the cleanup spot, or being the hitter that opposing lineups targeted going into a series of don't let this guy beat you. I think Vargas is maybe earning that reputation a little bit, especially during the times that Talkman and Benintendi were out. And then all of a sudden, like, you have three hitters that you want to see at the plate and then six afterwards. So it's a case of, like, yeah, it'd be stupid if Vargas hit a two-run homer here and yeah, when he had nothing behind him. So I think Vargas looks comfortable being pitched around or trying to be teased into a dribbler for an out versus, like, Robert just either expanding his zone or getting beat on pitches inside, or trying to feel like he has to cover everything versus having, like, a more targeted zone that he's trying to do damage on. And I think that's probably the difference or illustrates kind of difference that, you know, real solid earned plate discipline can do for you.
And then before Thursday's game, Andrew Benintendi has a 901 OPS with runners in scoring position for the White Sox. So if there's a runner on second, no outs or even one out, and you got Caro or Vargas or Benintendi, I'm starting to feel a little bit more confident, Jim, that the White Sox are going to cash in on that opportunity. It's not automatic, right? We're not talking about, like, the Dodgers offense or here's Aaron Judge batting with runners in scoring position, right? Really making opposing teams sweat.
The Judge Juan Soto decision from last year.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Whose stats do you want to pad for them? Type of decision. But it's getting better for the White Sox. And Edgar Caro, I tweeted this out. I still don't know what his ceiling is, Jim, but he is a smart hitter. And being able to make that adjustment, understand the situation, understand with a runner on third and one out, I just need to hit the ball hard to the infield to score this run. It's nice to see. And I think it's part of this change that Chris Getz and the White Sox front office are trying to implement, especially with new director of hitting Ryan Fuller, and just being a bit smarter in those situations to take advantage of the opportunity in front of you. Yes, this team needs to hit for more power, but the guys they currently have on the roster don't have a tremendous amount of power. The White Sox, I think, have to find those types of guys, but staying within your skill set and continue to move the line, that's working a lot better for the White Sox. And I think that's going a long way, even though they play, they're 4-17. You mentioned one run games. At least they played in 21 one run games this season and keeping things close.
Yeah. And this was the kind of loss where one run scores are a little bit misleading. You know, if Talkman didn't homer, they would have lost by two. And would you rather have that? No, of course not. So, you know, it's a telling stat, but also, you know, you can back yourself into one run games by, you know, having the bullpen get a little leaky. And then you could maybe had a 3-run win that turned into a 1-run win because your closer is iffy. Like, it's not one you can take at face value. You know, when it comes to non-extreme records, but in the case of 4-17, I think it tells a story of just being a little bit short. Sometimes the bullpen that's short, especially early in the season, that seems like it's solidified a little bit. Now it's a matter of just did they make that one error or have that extra out that cost them? Or did it, was it just a case of like Miguel Vargas needing, maybe catch it a millimeter closer to the barrel to get it out of the park? Like all of those ways that, good teams have a way of just having more opportunities to capitalize on. The White Sox just have to make the most out of fewer opportunities. And they're getting better at it, I think. But just, sometimes against good teams, this is how it shakes out.
Move over to the pitching side. Shane Smith picked up the White Sox one win against the Houston Astros in game one, as he went six innings, allowed seven hits, but only one earned run, walking two, striking out four. And this is back-to-back wins against playoff teams, Jim, for Shane Smith, because in his previous start against Detroit, he went five and a third innings, scoreless, three hits, allowed two walks and six strikeouts against the Tigers. And I know, Jim, we've gushed about Shane Smith all season long, since spring training when he was pumping 98, be like, who in the world is this guy that the White Sox got in the Rule 5 draft? And maybe you want to see him get into the seventh inning more consistently before granting him ace status. But I'm really impressed that he was able to come from a shaky start against the New York Mets, against the Tigers, who had the best record in Major League Baseball at the time, was able to be incredibly competitive against the Tigers, get the White Sox in position to take the lead and win that game. And then against the Houston Astros team leading the American League West, he stood his own and was able to limit that lineup to just one run. I continue to be impressed with how Shane Smith has been pitching, and I don't see any signs of him fading, even though this is really his first year in the major leagues coming from the Rule 5 draft.
Well, the start against Houston was a little bit funny just because he gave up a lot of hard hit balls. I think 15 of them over 95 miles per hour, only four strikeouts. Did not have his changeup the way that he's had it before. And so like that, he had to go more fastball, breaking ball, more of a traditional right-handed arsenal versus what's made of special this year. And I think the difference, or, what allowed him to succeed, is that he forced the Astros to hurt him. Like, he was efficient. He was in the zone, didn't have his best stuff, but you might see some pitchers when they don't have their go-to secondary pitch, their best strikeout offering, they might start nibbling. They might start being afraid of giving up, a 450-foot homer. And sometimes they do it before the other team shows their hand, shows the capability of doing so, and they get themselves into trouble. And then all it takes is, one, ball splitting the gap or a misplay in the infield. All of a sudden the floodgates open. In this case, like, Smith just competed. He went in the strike zone, was very aggressive, gave up a lot of line drives and hard hit grounders. The White Sox defensive positioning was pretty good, and I think that's been something that's been working for him this year. But he gave himself a chance to have quick innings, and he did. And so by the time the later innings came around, he's able to be a little bit finer and not have to live in the middle of the zone. And all of a sudden you look up and it's six innings and which he's not always guaranteed to finish based on the more restrictive pitch counts he's limited to. And he did it on fewer than 90 pitches. So I think that's what's cool about Smith, is like, he's not always on. He's not, like, say, Tarek Skubal or Paul Skenes or something like that, where every time you see him, you think like, oh, this guy's going to win the Cy Young. It's a case of sometimes it's sneaky how effective he is. But in this case, facing a good lineup, he didn't look scared. I think for a rookie pitcher, that goes a long way. It's a little bit from the Mark Burley school of like, if I'm going to get my ass kicked, it may as well be quick, which I always thought was easier said than done. But when you have like a career like Burley is, it makes sense when you can feel confident in backing it up with, if he throws a clunker, like coming out the next time, then throwing a quality start, like, nothing happened. And I think with Smith, between, like you said, coming off that Mets start, having, the Tigers and the Astros and facing them both, shows a certain amount of confidence that he just trusts his stuff. And given that he was a Rule 5 pick and he has evidence of his previous organization not trusting his stuff enough to protect him on the 40-man roster. Like it says quite a bit about his growth and what the White Sox have been able to do for him.
We've been podcasting for so long that we have talked through multiple examples where, as a White Sox fan, you feel confident when a particular starting pitcher is going on that day, even though the team's not very good. Back in 2014, Chris Sale. Hey, Sale's pitching today. We got a chance. 2019, Lucas Giolito. Giolito has bounced back in a big way. The White Sox got a chance. Garrett Crochet last year for the White Sox. Dylan Cease away in 2023 for the White Sox. And it just seems like with Shane Smith, especially in the last two starts, that I'm getting more confident that when Smith is on the mound, the White Sox have a chance. And for a team, like we mentioned in the intro, like even though this is another series loss, they have twice as many losses as wins this season. I do feel like things are turning around, because if you find a diamond in the rough like Shane Smith, who, by the way, is pre-arb, you know, well, along with Davis Martin, Jonathan Cannon, as far as building out a rotation, you're going to have a pretty good starting rotation on the cheap going into next year. That maybe things get better sooner than later because of the quality of the starting staff. It may be interesting to see how the White Sox handle Shane Smith as far as workload goes, post All-Star break, post trade deadline, to see if they reduce the amount of innings, because he is going to hit a career high. But these last two starts, being able to keep the Tigers scoreless and keep the Astros to one run, gives me confidence that maybe the White Sox not only found an effective starting pitcher, Jim, the Rule 5 draft, they may have found a frontline starter to replace the production that they were getting from Dylan Cease and Garrett Crochet.
Yeah, I think the only reason to pump the brakes right now is just durability, in-season durability of just what the second half is going to look like. But I think the toolkit is there for him to be somebody who, you know, number three feels like a conservative projection. And I think, you know, getting a number three starter from the Rule 5 draft is a hell of a trick. So, it's, you know, a tip of the cap to the White Sox for identifying him, but also, like, yeah, Smith has done a lot of it on his own. Like, the White Sox did not think they were getting their all-star from the Rule 5 draft. And, you know, potentially, we'll see how it, you know, when he gets to the, there's about a month left before it, and a lot can change in a month. But in terms of like the numbers he's posting right now, his numbers would fit right in terms of ERA, terms of, you know, maybe a little bit short on wins above replacement just because of the innings total being a little bit lower, because he's not, you know, getting past six innings. A lot of times stops at five. But yeah, he's a little bit like, you know, you mentioned Garrett Crochet, a little bit similar in terms of, you know, not as overpowering as Crochet, but, you know, should be fine while he's in there. And just a matter of if he can avoid that laborious inning, you know, like we saw in the Cubs outing, where just, you look at his pitch count early and think, will he get through four? And then usually he finds a way to get through four and then five. But, he shows a good ability to, you know, once he's out of that bad inning, he's able to close the door on it and start kind of a new and fresh. And I was looking at the White Sox record at this point last year, which was 17-52, you know, bad, not terribly different from 23-46, but, you know, in terms of winning percentage, in terms of projecting it, 23-46 is 108 losses, not 121, and 108 is more normal. But the difference in terms of feel, the White Sox run differential through 69 games this year is -58. You know what it was last year?
-106 or something.
Higher or lower. 150.
A 92 run improvement.
Yes. So,
wow.
Let me see how many one run games they played.
Wow. A 92 run.
So, a similar amount of one run games, right? You know, not terribly different, but yeah, just. They gave up 361 runs at that point.
Yeah.
So this year, 300. So yeah, it's a much better, just 1-5. And they were able to create some separation between last year's record, because, this was the point last year, or you know, I think last week, the 2024 White Sox had just snapped their 14 game losing streak. So that was a time for the White Sox to create some separation, because at that point, before the 14 game skid, the White Sox were only one game better, despite feeling considerably better. And so now it's showing up, okay, six games better, you know, gaining five games over this 14 game losing streak. That's what it should look like, and it is what it looks like.
Yeah, to act as a James Fegan and getting the hose out, the White Sox are going to have some bullpen days with Cannon being injured. There is some skepticism with Sean Burke. You don't know which version of Sean Burke you're going to get. Right now, it is Adrian Hauser, who is probably going to get traded before the deadline. Shane Smith, who's been good. I think Davis Martin's been throwing well as well. Mm-hmm. I mean, I know he's got a 2-7 record, but he's also keeping the White Sox competitive. He's keeping the White Sox in games. So with that said, like, one more injury and then all of a sudden we're doom and gloom. But right now in June, as we're approaching the halfway mark of the 2025 season, like, Shane Smith might be the biggest bright spot, along with the turnaround of his season, maybe of his career, for Miguel Vargas. Like I said in the intro, there's things to be hopeful for the White Sox, that things are getting better. Another thing to be excited about, we've talked about the struggles for the White Sox in the bullpen, the lack of premium arms. Well, they got a big one for this series, as Grant Taylor was called up straight from Birmingham to Houston to join the White Sox to face the Astros. Jim, you called in the last podcast episode, we had that question from Andrew asking, hey, who is the next prospect to make their Major League Baseball debut? You called it. You sent Grant Taylor. Grant Taylor's now with the White Sox. Two outings, two scoreless outings. He did give up a couple singles on Thursday in his second outing against the Astros. We saw that elite velocity hitting 101 miles per hour. He did get his first Major League strikeout. What are your early thoughts about Grant Taylor, Jim?
This stuff plays, is the short version. Early, and especially coming out with 101.5 miles per hour out of the gates, throwing the six fastest pitches by a White Sox pitcher this year. Cam Boozer had topped out at 99.6. Taylor hit that and then threw five that were 100 or more without even rounding. You know, that showed up, but the command of the secondary pitches wasn't quite there. You could see the adrenaline a little bit in terms of, seemed like he was gripping the slider or cutter a little bit too hard. Threw like one good one, but otherwise it's getting by in velocity and just having a varied enough pitch mix to where, you know, the Astros couldn't really cheat on velocity. They had to respect it. This time around, you know, he tried to set the agenda with the fastball. The Astros looked more ready for it, but then he was able to switch up these sequences, especially. I'm a big fan of his curveball. You know, he's got two good ones in terms of, like, he's got a strike grabber and he's got a, you know, real nasty, just 12-6 or 11-5, but just a real sharp diver that contrasts nicely with the slider. Like, there's no blending between Taylor's slider and his curveball. And when he has it, it's nasty just because he can throw it two times in a row. Like, it has enough break and strike grabbing mode to where even if they see it once, you know, it kind of reminds me, you know, this conversation reminds me of Dylan Cease's changeup, you know, the goofy floating one that would be like 20 miles per hour slower than his fastball. And he could get away with it like in a first pitch and hitters wouldn't be ready for it. But like, he never threw it two times in a row because it would just be, yeah, basically like position player pitching if you try to do it two times in a row. And sometimes with curveballs, you see it too, like getting a little bit too cute with throwing your worst pitch or like your second worst pitch. But in the case of Taylor, like, even his strike grabbing version, you know, it's not quite causing knees to buckle, but it's the kind where it has a sharp enough break to where hitters can adjust to it if they're not looking for spin. So watching him in Birmingham, especially seeing him up close and seeing him do that, like curve, and then all of a sudden it's 0-2, and now he's got his whole bevy of pitches ready to go. That's something I think that, you know, really makes him special and just allows him to have multiple ways to succeed, but also multiple ways to adjust. Like, I don't know. Yeah, I think he's going to go through the typical command slumps, or maybe have a couple games where you realize, like, oh, hitters are really talented when they can turn around 101. Like we saw with like Jake Berger against Michael Kopech last year. Just, you know, elite fastball, but, you know, elite hitters can hit those fastballs if they know they're coming. It's the only pitch he's got that he trusts. But I think overall, as he gets used to pitching, you know, in a major league bullpen and gets accustomed to the dog days of summer and pitching on back-to-back days and, you know, maybe warming up in a hurry, going through all of the various scenarios that relievers are called upon and starts getting more confidence in himself in all the situations, like, he should be very good at this.
I agree. And I think it leads to the conversation that some are having, not understanding why the White Sox called up Grant Taylor to the major leagues, why Taylor is in the bullpen. And again, Taylor missed his junior year at LSU. He was supposed to be the Saturday night starter behind Paul Skeens for that amazing LSU national championship winning team. Like, if Taylor
wasn't
healthy,
originally considered, like, didn't Skeens leapfrog him? Like, wasn't Taylor presumed to be the Friday night starter before Skeens made the leap?
Yeah, in the fall, the assumption was that Taylor would start Friday because Skeens had just transferred from Air Force over to LSU. Skeens was still going to be better than Taylor, but if Taylor's healthy his junior year, he doesn't fall to the White Sox in the second round. He has a first round type of arm, and he's with a different organization. But because he did, and he had Tommy John surgery, and he's also had, what, lat injuries with the White Sox as well, and he's missed time. I mentioned this when I was on White Sox Weekly a couple of weeks ago during a pregame show before the White Sox played. And I made this point then, and I'm going to make this point now on our show, Jim. I think for all parties involved, the White Sox and even Grant Taylor, I think that there is an understanding that they have not made publicly known to calm the fears of White Sox fans. So let's attempt to do that. And I know you wrote about this on SoxMachine.com, and I agree with you. If Taylor does not have the arm that can sustain a workload to be a starting pitcher and grab the ball every 5 days and throw 90 to 100 pitches with this type of premium stuff, and it's better for him because he's got limited amount of bullets to come out of the bullpen, that's fine. Like, the White Sox need premium relievers as well. And I know that it's so enticing of, like, man, can you imagine, Jimmy, starting pitcher throwing 101 miles per hour? But even James was telling us stories like Brian Bannister, and Bannister being on 670 The Score, using Tyler Glasnow as a comp for Grant Taylor. How many times in the years that we've been podcasting, Jim, pondering, man, could you imagine if Glasnow can throw 150 innings? But he never does. Mm-hmm. And he's hurt again. So there might be a question for the Dodgers of, like, should we move Glasnow to the bullpen? Because we just can't keep him healthy. Maybe it's smart for the White Sox to get ahead of this. Maybe even for Grant Taylor as well. This is what Taylor wants. And from everything that I saw in the video of him getting the call up, and I know you got a chance to chat with him as well when covering Birmingham, it seems like he's eager for this role. I say run with it. And it's okay if the starter dreams are squashed. The White Sox need premium relievers, and Grant Taylor can certainly be one.
Yeah, the thing about Taylor, and, you know, when I'm watching games in Birmingham, I'm also taking photos for our sites, and it's fun taking photos of pitchers, and I take, you know, tons of them. Like, just, you know, just hold the shutter down and just try to get the best kind of grip photos, release photos, everything like that. So I'm looking at, like, who knows, dozens of photos of a pitcher. Yeah, maybe 20 of them for a reliever, and then who knows, like 100 of them for a starter, like, over the course of innings before I, like, sit back and actually watch the pitches for myself. But with Taylor, like, he just launches himself off the rubber. Like, he, you know, you can see just the extension, just how far out he's coming, how far out the arm is, how far it's reaching back. Like, he puts his whole body into it. And I was asking him, as a starter, did he air it out then? And he said, yeah, I was basically throwing three innings. And I think that's partially because he knew he was throwing three innings, he was airing it out. But also, his delivery is aimed towards, and he says, like, he feels like his mechanics are better synced up when he is throwing 100% versus trying to, like, soften it. And yeah, if you're counting on, you know, 7.5 feet of extension that Brian Bannister talks about, like, you have to get your body out there And I don't know if you can say, I'm going to ease up on this one and still get that kind of launch without your arm being late or something like that. So I think, James put in the comments that it's a very Dodgers-y type arm. And we see the Dodgers lose pitchers all the time because they can't keep any of them healthy. And, they always have eight starting pitchers and then they're pitching like swingmen by mid-May and trying to figure out what happened to all our guys. And so I think with Taylor, it's had he not already lost a season effectively to a lat strain, perhaps they could keep it going and say, he threw 80 innings. He did the Noah Schultz plan of throwing four innings once a week. He checked off that box. He showed the ability to recover well enough on a 6-day cycle in between starts, and his stuff held up fine for four innings. So let's take it to the next step. But only throwing 16 innings in his first season after missing all of Tommy John's, all of his junior season because of Tommy John, it really shortens the margin for error in terms of, developing him into something where if he has one more injury, then okay, now he's missed two full years on top of a Tommy John year. So if you don't feel confident with it and you're sitting on a reliever who could be one of the best closers in the game, you can see why the White Sox would choose that route, even if a closer is really the last thing a closer is not the last thing they need in terms of winning games. We've seen some, we've seen their difficulties converting the few traditional save opportunities they've had. But in terms of like the overall project, like a starter is more valuable to them than a closer at this point in their, the contention cycle, or the contention cycle has not even begun. So what's a closer worth? That's where it feels like a little bit short, but I would default to Brian Bannister here and say, if you know characteristics of guys who fall apart after 60 innings or throwing their body like that every 5 days, four or five innings, then you might be just feeling like you're, it's like, never tell me the odds, but in this case, it's a human body on the other end. Like you want to know the odds a little bit, especially if there's a spot that he slots in neatly, they can very much use.
Well, we'll hopefully see Grant Taylor soon get a save opportunity. Brandon Eichert, we talked about that. Eichert picked up another save. He leads the White Sox in saves.
Two.
With two. My preseason prediction was six. Ted Murphy, he's not even on the team anymore. Murph Dog's gone, but let's see if anyone gets a six, but it'll be exciting to see if Grant Taylor gets a chance to close out a game for the White Sox soon and pick up his first major league save. But I'm in favor of this move for the White Sox, even though I know there's a lot of pushback right now, especially in Sox Machine comments of you should still try to stretch him out to a starter. I think everyone, the White Sox, even Grant himself, knows that his arm just can't handle that workload. So why not start making some major league money?
Or it's like, maybe it can, but like the job's right in front of him. Yeah. The job pays well.
The job does pay well.
It's not a case of like, oh, he's just going to get chewed up and spit out and he'll be a non-tendered before he gets to his final RB or like, no, he'll be fine. Assuming, he does what he's doing.
A Sox Machine public service announcement. We have brand new items in the Sox Machine store. With the weather heating up, we've got new Adidas Sox Machine polos, perfect for your company outings, casual Fridays, and of course the golf course. It's part of our media attire as well when covering events. You can grab any of these three styles that we now have in the store. We've got new Sox Machine coffee mugs to sip from while you read Jim and James in the morning, new stainless steel water bottles with the Sox Machine logo, and fanny packs, which fanny packs have been very helpful entering Major League Baseball stadiums with all the bag restrictions. Visit shop.soxmachine.com to check out the new gear. And for Sox Machine subscribers, remember your discount code to get an additional discount when checking out. Again, the URL is shop.soxmachine.com. Well, this Texas road trip for the White Sox continues as they will be heading to Arlington, Texas this weekend. The Texas Rangers are 33-36 this season. They won their last game. They won the series in Minneapolis, winning 2 out of 3 against the Twins. Their last 10, they are 5-5. They've been a lot better at home. They are 20-13 this year at home. Now, offensively, the Rangers are averaging 3.7 runs per game. That's not good. But they scored 16 runs against the Twins on Tuesday and Thursday. They put up 34 runs in those three games against the Minnesota Twins. So there could be some hot bats the White Sox may have to maneuver around this weekend. Team OPS for the Rangers, one of the worst in Major League Baseball, 660, that's 27th in baseball. Their home OPS is worse. They are the worst hitting team at home in Major League Baseball. Their team OPS is 631. Despite hitting 75 home runs as a team, that's good for 11th in Major League Baseball. However, the pitching has been phenomenal for the Rangers. Their starter ERA is 3.05. That's third in Major League Baseball. The bullpen, 3.46 on the season. That's eighth in Major League Baseball. The Rangers pitching staff, ERA at home, starters and relievers combined, 2.52. That's second in Major League Baseball. So the worst home hitting team, one of the best home pitching teams in Major League Baseball. So this could be an interesting series for the Chicago White Sox. Your pitching probables for this series, Friday, June 13th at 7:05 p.m. Central Time, to be determined for the Rangers, but it'll be Adrian Hauser for the White Sox. Saturday afternoon, 3:05 p.m. Central Time on June 14th, this is going to be a bullpen day for the White Sox. Jacob DeGrom will take the ball for the Rangers. And Sunday at 1:35 p.m. Central Time, Shane Smith against to be determined for the Rangers. Hopefully James makes his flight in time Friday morning to get to Arlington. But a fun little topic, because this is Texas and the White Sox are on a Texas road trip. Maybe next year, Jim, if they have these back-to-back series with Houston and Texas next year, we should force James to drive so he can stop at Bucky's and get us some gifts that he can send back or bring back with him to Chicago. Have you ever been to Bucky's, Jim?
I have. There's one in between Nashville and Birmingham. Oh, nice. So I've stopped there a few times on, you know, right on 65. And I don't, you know, the thing about Bucky's is going there. Just awash in roadside capitalism. Like, it's massive. And it's just very much like all of the gas pumps, like, you know, America being a car culture, you know, car-based transportation culture. And then you go inside and just every kind of jerky, every kind of way to intake sodium is available to you, like spread out and impeccably clean too. Like it's a great place. Like in terms of, you can always trust the bathrooms there when you're stopping there and you need to like change a kid. It's a good place to stop because you know that they will have very spacious and clean changing facilities to get that done. So yeah, but in terms of like bringing stuff back, you miss out. You know, you'd say like, oh, what's this about? And like, you just kind of have to go there and just contemplate the number of people who are there, especially like on a weekend. If you stop there, like I drove back from Rickwood on a Wednesday, no problem finding a gas pump, no problem finding a parking spot, like within the first row. Easiest time ever there. But if I'm going to Birmingham, coming back on a Sunday when everybody's coming back from like the Gulf Coast or something like that, and I try to stop there, most of the time I don't, because just the line going to the exits is enormous.
Really?
And it's good, but it's not quite worth it. Like, you know, or you can just see it wrapping around, especially looking for gas pumps, like not worth that fight, even though the gas is cheaper. But yeah, it's something to be experienced more than, you know, having something to bring back and feel like you know what it's about.
I feel like they're going to build a Bucky's around Chicago, maybe even in Wisconsin, like between Milwaukee and Chicago. I may have read
are,
that, yeah, but
are they doing like they do very aggressive billboard advertising, even like in states that they don't exist in, even in like states that even neighboring states don't exist in. Like you'll see a sign saying next Bucky's 1,470 miles. And it reminds me of Sonic. Upstate New York, when I lived in Albany, did not have Sonic for most of the time I was there, but you still got all the national advertisements, the two guys in the car, like they were very familiar, yeah, especially during college football season. So when Sonic finally opened up, traffic, you know, cops were needed to direct traffic for like the first month, even though it's just normal fast food, like the drinks are good. Like it's, I like Sonic now and then, but just, because they had just primed the markets for, you know, what's this all about? Why do people why have I heard so much about this, even though there's never been a Sonic anywhere near me? Just the curiosity just got to everybody. And I didn't even bother going for the first month because I've been to Sonic in Missouri. Like it's good. I know what it's about. Would like to go there, but I know it's not worth devoting 45 minutes to get through it. So yeah. I waited and eventually it calmed down. But I think Bucky is probably, billboard advertising is pretty cheap. So if they can just kind of keep those embers of curiosity alive, if they ever do launch somewhere, they will be in that kind of position to just get every traveler who's going through that corridor.
Yeah, because you just have to know. And the Bucky's experience that I had was in between Austin, Texas and Arlington. So driving from our dude's trip in Austin to go watch the White Sox against the Rangers, we stopped at Bucky's along the way. So that's why I bring this up, that maybe we should force James next year to either drive from Houston to Dallas so he could stop at Bucky's.
It would be for his own edification, though. Yeah, nobody else would get anything out of it as much as he would get if he's never been.
That is true. So let us know your guys' Bucky's experience, but I just bring it up because when I think of Texas, I think of Bucky's. Again, back to baseball. This Rangers team putting up 34 runs against the Minnesota Twins, even though they've been the worst hitting team at home this year and still one of the best pitching teams at home this year. The White Sox do have Adrian Hauser and they do have Shane Smith this weekend, Jim. I feel like this is going to be another tight series for the White Sox. How are you feeling about this series for the White Sox against the Rangers?
It feels like it could be similar to what we just watched.
Good point.
I think the Rangers are rounding into form, like Marcus Semien being good versus one of the worst hitters in baseball, at least among regular position players, I think is one of those transformations that turns a lineup from being pretty hard to watch to being like, oh yeah, this is what everybody expected. I think it's different, compared to like, Jake Berger, he's naturally hot and cold. Adolis Garcia is somebody who, when he's on one of his heaters, like it's impressive, but he can also expand his zone and make a lot of unimpressive outs. And sometimes the OBP gets away from him. And so, kind of the deal there, same thing with Wyatt Langford, like just, he's a good hitter, but the power maybe isn't quite, he's still maturing into his power. Whereas Semien was supposed to, I think Semien and Corey Seager are supposed to be like the two complete hitters that just center that lineup. And, Seager's missed time and Semien was pretty woeful. And now that he's, I think he's got a 4-digit OPS in June, like that makes a huge difference, I think. And that's, we're starting to see that when the White Sox played the Rangers last time, that Semien was hitting balls harder and had some success, but also had some balls that, good positioning took away hits, but the kind where if he keeps hitting the ball that hard, like the results will show up and the results are showing up. So I think it's going to be a little bit tougher test and the lineup will be a little bit longer. And, it's a case where, especially, Adrian Hauser is one thing because he's a veteran, the White Sox are going to trade him, but just what we saw with Smith against Houston, same thing against the Rangers, like, how do you compete against, good, one dangerous power bats who can turn an inning around with one swing, and then like hitters like Semien who are just can wait you out and drive the ball the other way and pull mistakes like they. Semien being around and I've been a fan of his for a long time and I was a little bit worried given how many games he's played. He's usually good for 162 every season. I could see like the decline showing up pretty suddenly for him, just given everything he puts his body through. So the first couple months were a little bit scary, but seeing him back just like, oh, that's good. Cause I liked him as a White Sox prospect. Been happy to see him develop the way he has, even if it makes the White Sox look kind of foolish. And even though, especially when he was with Oakland, he seemed to be in that group that, took some satisfaction out of, having great games against the White Sox.
In his last 15 games, Semien is 19 for 51. That's a .373 on batting average. His on-base percentage is .439. And he's slugging .667 with four homers and 10 RBIs, just six walks to seven strikeouts. Even his last 30 games, he's got an on-base percentage of .368 and slugging .455. So to your point, Jim, Marcus Semien is rounding into shape. And it'll be a tough test for Adrian Hauser and Shane Smith, but if Hauser has another excellent start on Friday, I have to imagine Chris Getz is getting more text messages about the trade availability of Adrian Hauser. And like we just bragged about earlier in the show, if Shane Smith can keep the Rangers to a minimum with runs, that's just another feather in his cap to continue this excellent run that Shane Smith has had. Saturday could be a disaster as far as bullpen day goes. Good luck.
Yeah,
it's gonna be Tyler Alexander.
Wilson, yeah, or Tyler Alexander, etc. Like maybe Tyler Alexander. He looked okay coming off of a 90-minute Uber ride, so perhaps fully rested and part of the team's plans. Like he might even look better. Who knows? But yeah, it's Jonathan Cannon's injury. Back injuries are tough. I questioned, like, put him on a plane, really, if his lower back's tight, and, like, do you really see a value in flying him, having him on the road trip? Like, that seems a little bit optimistic. I know that they're trying to, avoid all these bullpen games and really they don't want to look the Mike Vassell gift horse in the mouth too much in terms of they're already asking a lot and getting a lot from him. The peripherals aren't great. Like, do you want to keep trying to stretch him out for three innings and exposing him when you're just trying to get him through 6 months on the active roster? Like, yeah, it's, you know, Shane Smith is a great find. Having two Rule 5 picks being not the problem on a pitching staff is awesome luck. And I think they're reluctant to try to push Vassell harder than they have to. Keep pitching himself in opportunities, but also not be in a position where they have to rely on him. And if it turns, like, now they're like looking down the barrel of having to keep on the roster for 3 months when he should be in Charlotte. Like, that's the tricky part with him. So that's why they keep looking at Owen White and Tyler Alexander, like you said. But here's hoping Cannon gets better. But yeah, I do wish that Cannon stayed home just because it didn't, based on the reports, what James was saying, the video of him throwing, like, didn't look like he was throwing free and easy. And it might be a bit.
Hey, Aaron Civale wants a trade for Milwaukee.
Yeah, that did cross my mind. Like, they seem to like Brewers.
Yeah. That's a possibility. I don't know what the White Sox could trade to Milwaukee for Aaron Civale to help out with the starting rotation. But I don't know. Maybe it's three innings of Mike Vassell, three innings of Tyler Alexander. Owen White, finish the game. Minimize the amount of bullpen use on Saturday. But hopefully the White Sox do find a way to score some runs. Runs are going to be a premium for the White Sox this weekend against the Texas Rangers, again, who have been pitching exceptionally well at home this year. And of course, we'll be recapping all the games this weekend. So visit SoxMachine.com in case if you do miss any of the action with being the weekend. And we'll recap that series in the next Sox Machine podcast as James will join us. Again, he's down in Texas. Huge thank you again to all of our Sox Machine subscribers for allowing James to go on this Texas road trip to cover back-to-back series in Houston and in Arlington. And to wrap up, and I'll have more of an in-depth preview on SoxMachine.com Friday morning, but it is the College World Series. 10 in the morning, the Dick Houser Award will be announced. That's one of the Player of the Year awards. I will also have my ballot posted on SoxMachine.com so you can see on how I voted for the Dick Houser Award. It's an honor to be able to do that. It's very fun, a very stressful experience, but you can see how I ranked the 8 players for the final award, and I pick one player to follow during the College World Series of the 8 schools for MLB draft purposes. 7 for the 2025 MLB draft. I do have one for the 2026 MLB draft to keep an eye on. But Jim, I have to ask you, again, this is one of my favorite events of the year. I get very excited about the College World Series. I'm sharing screen time between the White Sox and what's happening in Omaha. Do you get excited for the College World Series?
I get excited that you're excited. I don't follow it closely enough to really, it doesn't resonate with me, but in terms of, I like watching the fans enjoy it. So I kind of ride the enthusiasm. I piggyback off the enthusiasm of others. Like, it doesn't hit with me the same way. So I won't pretend that, oh yeah, College World Series, this is my season. Like, not quite. I would be happy to go there. Like, it'd be a case of, would love to go there at some point, cross off my list, see if it turns me into a convert. Because you talk about the way Jim Callis talks about, the way Mike Farron talks about it. Like, there is something there. There is something to going there. And yeah, it should be on my baseball list of things to do, things to see. But just in terms of not following the teams close enough or not really being invested in the outcome of games. It's something I'll tune into if nothing else is on, but given that I have very little control over the TV in my house, whenever it's on, that I don't really get a chance to drop in casually and absorb it to start forming opinions and start forming, ties to teams or investments and outcomes and stories. So it's more a matter of like, I tend to follow it more retroactively in terms of the highlights. So let me go back and see what happened there. Or let me see what people are saying about this pitching performance or how this is going to be reflective of draft stock. I like piecing it together afterwards, but yeah, in terms of being hooked by college baseball, not quite there. It doesn't help that Missouri has been pretty miserable in the SEC last couple of years. So like that
doesn't help.
but yeah, even then, like, I'm able to enjoy it, but it's more your thing than mine in terms of just the two screening it or three screening it or two screening it, but having four games on one screen. Yeah, that sort of thing, which I think is probably more of your viewing station, your command center.
Yeah, it was a couple of weeks ago during regionals where they had like their red zone version on the big monitor for me and the White Sox and the other monitor. I love the fact that the White Sox are playing around 3 o'clock on Saturday because we could watch the White Sox and Rangers game. 6 p.m. Central Time on Saturday night. Get yourself a pizza. If you've got no plans and you just want to chill, LSU Arkansas is going to be a sellout in Omaha. It's going to be a raucous crowd. Both fan bases are phenomenal, especially in baseball, traveling wise. You're going to get a chance to see Cade Anderson, the starting pitcher for LSU, who might now go number one overall in the upcoming MLB draft. He reminds me a lot of Max Fried. If there's one College World Series game that you can tune in Saturday night, 6 p.m. Central Time on ESPN, that's the game. And I agree with a lot of people. That's like, that might be the national championship because whoever loses goes into the loser's bracket and they're just behind the eight ball. And I like LSU to win the College World Series this year. I was hoping that Florida State would make it, but they had some bullpen messes in the Super Regionals against Oregon State. But again, you can go to SoxMachine.com. I list one player for each school to follow and keep track of, maybe targets for the Chicago White Sox. Also, Friday morning, we have some White Sox draft dope that's really interesting. And you've been following along with my draft coverage all college baseball season long. This is a very familiar name. And as it appears that the White Sox, their list of players that they are considering at pick 10 overall is narrowing. And somebody went on Instagram and posted a story that gave us a pretty big clue what school that the White Sox are circling right now when it comes to draft choices in the upcoming MLB draft. So that's a huge teaser for you. Again, that will be on SoxMachine.com. I have that post unlocked for everyone to read. A great way to also help us support us by becoming a subscriber.
And I will say with your coverage, as somebody who does not follow the college season over the course of the year, your coverage is basically my leading window into that world in terms of like when I, you know, when I'm editing the posts and everything like that, like I click on the links, see the video you cut. And by the time the College World Series comes around, like I feel pretty well informed in terms of which rosters have more, which ones, you know, are not just, you know, have the Friday night starter, but also are equipped to win games 2 and 3 and, you know, players I should watch or for, or be skeptical about when it comes to the White Sox, maybe being considering drafting them. So yeah, Josh's coverage is great. It's very much, especially when it comes to looking at through a White Sox lens of who's around at pick 10, who might be around in second round or later. It's very handy just to be a great starting point for following college baseball and then supplementing it from, you know, the more general coverage from Baseball America and the ESPN, you know, ESPN does a great job broadcasting in terms of all the presentation they do as you're watching the games. Like that's also excellent, very informative in a way that, you know, people criticize the Major League Baseball portion of ESPN's programming for being very, tilted towards big stories or big programs. But in the case of like college baseball and being not that familiar with it, when I'm watching a game, I feel like I'm pretty locked in terms of who the key players are, what they've been doing, weaknesses, streaks, slumps, et cetera, to where like when they're building up a big moment, they've done it sufficiently. And I feel ready for it versus like totally surprised or feeling like it's totally random.
Yeah, like Yankees Red Sox on Sunday night. I know the Red Sox were struggling. I didn't know how bad they were struggling, but ESPN sure made it feel like they're still in it.
Yeah.
I don't know about that. But yeah, ESPN does a fantastic job with the coverage of college baseball. So enjoy the College World Series. Enjoy the White Sox and Rangers. They're on Comcast now. So if you haven't upgraded already to the premium tier, if you're a Comcast cable subscriber, you can do so. I think they're also giving a discount for a month or a couple months by making that upgrade. So more opportunities for everyone to watch, even though the over-the-air option is going to start fading away for many of those in the Chicagoland area. And if you're just busy and you can't watch the White Sox this weekend, we got you covered at SoxMachine.com. That will do it for this episode of the Sox Machine Podcast. Thank you guys so much for listening. If you just discovered the show, you can subscribe to the show wherever you listen to podcasts, such as Spotify and Apple Music. You could also listen and watch our videos at youtube.com/SoxMachine. I'm going to have more draft videos from the College World Series of these top prospects, not just guys that can be taken the first round, but also in the second and later rounds as well. So we start having some of that type of film just in case if the White Sox do select these types of players, especially from rounds 2 through 15. The White Sox usually jump on somebody that plays in the College World Series. So I'll try to get as much film as I possibly can over the next week of all the action in Omaha. Again, you can subscribe at youtube.com/SoxMachine. We're on all the social media platforms at SoxMachine. You can follow James at JR Fegan. You can follow me at SoxMachine_Josh. We're on Blue Sky, real simple, at SoxMachine.com. JRFegan.SoxMachine.com, and I'm Josh.SoxMachine.com. I mentioned before, thanks to our Sox Machine subscribers for supporting us, allowing James to go on the road. If you're not a Sox Machine subscriber and you would like to take advantage of all the benefits, the ad-free version of the podcast, the ad-free version of the website, the comment section unlocked, we have additional tiers of support with additional benefits, even some spots open at our Veterans Committee so you can be in a group chat with us, especially with the trade deadline coming up. Whatever gossip and rumors that we are hearing, we share them in the group chat. If you want that type of insight and access, go to SoxMachine.com and sign up for a subscription. Monthly plans start at $5. The Sox Machine Podcast is a production of SoxMachine.com, your home for all things Chicago White Sox baseball and part of the Blue Wire Podcast Network. Alongside Jim Margulis, I'm Josh Nelson. Thanks for listening and watching.